Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Do you feel like you're going through life clouded by doubt? Talk to California Psychics. Our trusted and accurate psychics are available 24/7, and we guarantee if it's not life-changing, it's free. Download the app or connect with us at californiapsychics.com. Right now, new customers get 80% off their first reading. Experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.
Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. My Red Cap, Part 1, by Louisa May Alcott. He who serves well need not fear to ask his wages. It was under a blue cap that I first saw the honest face of Joe Collins. In the third year of the late war, a Maine regiment was passing through Boston on its way to Washington. The common was all alive with troops, and the spectators who clustered round them to say Godspeed as the brave fellows marched away to meet danger and death for our sakes. Everyone was eager to do something, and, as the men stood at ease, the people mingled freely with them, offering gifts, hearty grips of the hand, and hopeful prophecies of victory in the end. Irresistibly attracted, my boy Tom and I drew near, and soon, becoming excited by the scene, ravaged the fruit stands in our neighborhood for tokens of our regard, mingling candy and congratulations, peanuts and prayers, apples and applesauce, in one enthusiastic jumble. While Tom was off on his third raid, my attention was attracted by a man who stood a little apart, looking as if his thoughts were far away. All the men were fine, stalwart fellows, as Maine men usually are, but this one overtopped his comrades, standing straight and tall as a Norway pine, with a face full of the mingled shrewdness, sobriety, and self-possession of the typical New Englander. I liked the look of him, and seeing that he seemed solitary, even in a crowd, I offered him my last apple with a word of interest. The keen blue eyes met mine gratefully, and the apple began to vanish in vigorous bites as we talked, for no one thought of ceremony at such a time. "Where are you from?"
"Woolwich, ma'am."
"Are you glad to go?"
"Well, there's two sides to that question. I calculate to do my duty, and do it hearty, but it is rough on a feller leaving his folks for good, maybe."
There was a sudden huskiness in the man's voice that was not Appleskin's, though he tried to make believe that it was. I knew a word about home would comfort him, so I went on with my questions. "Is it very hard? Do you leave a family?"
"My old mother, a sick brother, and Lucindy."
The last word was uttered in a tone of intense regret, and his brown cheek reddened as he added hastily to hide some embarrassment,
"You see, Jim went last year and got pretty well used up, so I felt as if I'd ought to take my turn now. Mother was a regular old hero about it, and I dropped everything and come off. Lucindy didn't think it was my duty, and that made it awful hard, I tell you. "Wives are less patriotic than mothers," I began, but he would not hear Lucindy blamed, and said quickly, "She ain't my wife yet, but we calculated to be married in a month or so, and it was worse for her than me. Women lot so on not being disappointed. I couldn't shrink, and here I be. When I get to work, I shall be all right. The first wrench is the tryin' part." Here he straightened his broad shoulders and turned his face toward the flags fluttering far in front, as if no backward look should betray the longing of his heart for mother, home, and wife. I liked that little glimpse of character, and when Tom returned with empty hands, reporting that every stall was exhausted, I told him to find out what the man would like best, then run across the street and get it. "I know without asking. Give us your purse and I'll make him as happy as a king," said the boy, laughing, as he looked up admiringly at our tall friend, who looked down on him with an elder brotherly air pleasant to see. While Tom was gone, I found out Joe's name and business, promised to write and tell his mother how finely the regiment went off, and was just expressing a hope that we might meet again, for I, too, was going to the war as a nurse, when the order to fall in came rolling down the ranks, and the talk was over. Fearing Tom would miss our man in the confusion, I kept my eye on him till the boy came rushing up with a packet of tobacco in one hand and a good supply of cigars in the other. Not a romantic offering, certainly, but a very acceptable one, as Joe's face proved, as we scrambled these treasures into his pockets, all laughing at the flurry, while less fortunate comrades helped us, with an eye to a share of these fragrant luxuries by and by. There was just time for this, a hearty shake of the big hand, and a grateful, "Goodbye, ma'am." Then the word was given, and they were off. Bent on seeing the last of them, Tom and I took a short cut, and came out on the wide street down which so many troops marched that year, and mounting some high steps, we watched for our man, as we already called him. As the inspiring music, the grand tramp, drew near, the old shrill went through the crowd, the old cheer broke out. But it was a different scene now than in the first enthusiastic, hopeful days. Young men and ardent boys filled the ranks then, brave by instinct, burning with loyal zeal, and blissfully unconscious of all that lay before them. Now the blue coats were worn by mature men, some gray, all grave and resolute, husbands and fathers, with the memories of wives and children tugging at their heartstrings, homes left desolate behind them, and before them the grim certainty of danger, hardship, and perhaps the lifelong helplessness worse than death. Little of the glamour of romance about the war now. They saw it as it was, a long, hard task, and here were the men to do it well. Even the lookers-on were different now. Once, all was wild enthusiasm and glad uproar. Now, men's lips were set, and women smileless as they cheered. Fewer handkerchiefs whitened the air, for wet eyes needed them. And sudden lulls, almost solemn in their stillness, followed the acclamations of the crowd. All watched with quickened breath, and brave souls that living wave blew below and bright with a steely glitter above, as it flowed down the street and away to distant battlefields already stained with precious blood. There he is, the outside man, and tallest of the lot. Give him a cheer, Auntie. He sees us and remembers," cried Tom, nearly tumbling off his perch, as he waved his hat and pointed out Joe Collins. Yes, there he was, looking up with a smile on his brave brown face, my little nosegay in his buttonhole, a suspicious bulge in the pocket close by, and doubtless a comfortable quid in his mouth to cheer the weary march. How like an old friend he looked, though we had only met 15 minutes ago. How glad we were to be there to smile back at him and send him on his way feeling that, even in a strange city, there was someone to say, "God bless you, Joe." We watched the tallest blue cap till it vanished, and then went home in a glow of patriotism, Tom to long for his turn to come, I to sew vigorously on the gray gown the new nurse burned to wear as soon as possible, and both of us to think and speak often of poor Joe Collins and his Lucindy. All this happened long ago, but it is well to recall those stirring times, to keep fresh the memory of sacrifices made for us by men like these, to see to it that the debt we owe them is honestly, gladly paid, and while we decorate the graves of those who died, to remember also those who still live and deserve our grateful care. End of part one. Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. My Red Cap, Part 2, by Louisa May Alcott. I never expected to see Joe again, but 6 months later, we did meet in a Washington hospital one winter's night. A train of ambulances had left their sad freight at our door, and we were hurrying to get the poor fellows into much-needed beds after a week of hunger, cold, and unavoidable neglect. All forms of pain were in my ward that night, and all bore with the pathetic patience which was a daily marvel to those who saw it. Trying to bring order out of chaos, I was rushing up and down the narrow aisle between the rows of rapidly filling beds, and after brushing several times against a pair of the largest and muddiest boots I ever saw, I paused at last to inquire why they were impeding the passageway. I found they belonged to a very tall man who seemed to be already asleep or dead. So white and still and utterly worn out he looked as he lay there, without a coat, a great patch on his forehead, and the right arm rudely bundled up. Stooping to cover him, I saw that he was unconscious, and whipping out my brandy bottle and salts soon brought him round, for it was only exhaustion. "Can you eat?" I asked, as he said, "Thank you, ma'am," after a long draught of water and a dizzy stare. "Eat! I'm starvin'," he answered, with such a ravenous glance at a fat nurse who happened to be passing that I trembled for her and hastened to take a bowl of soup from her tray. As I fed him, his gaunt, weather-beaten face had a familiar look, but so many faces had passed before me that winter, I did not recall this one till the ward master came to put up the cards with the newcomers' names above their beds. My man seemed absorbed in his food, but I naturally glanced at the card, and there was the name Joseph Collins to give me an additional interest in my new patient. "Why, Joe, is it really you?" I exclaimed,
pouring the last spoonful of soup down his throat so hastily that I choked him. "All that's left of me, while ain't this luck now," gasped Joe, as gratefully as if that hospital cot was a bed of roses. "What is the matter? A wound in the head and arm?" I asked, feeling sure that no slight affliction had brought Joe there.
"Right arm gone. Shot off as slick as a whistle. I tell you, it's a singler kind of a feelin' to see a piece of your own body go flying away with no prospect of ever coming back again," said Joe, trying to make light of one of the greatest misfortunes a man can suffer.
"That is bad, but it might have been worse. Keep up your spirits, Joe. We will soon have you fitted out with a new arm almost as good as new."
"I guess it won't do much lumbering, so that trade is done for. I s'pose there's things left-handed fellers can do, and I must learn 'em as soon as possible, since my fightin' days are over."
And Joe looked at his one arm with a sigh that was almost a groan. Helplessness is such a trial to a manly man, and he was eminently so.
"What can I do to comfort you most, Joe? I'll send my good Ben to help you to bed, and will be here myself when the surgeon goes his rounds. Is there anything else that would make you more easy?"
"If you could just drop a line to Mother to let her know I'm alive, it would be a sight of comfort to both of us. I guess I'm in for a long spell of hospital, and I'd lay easier if I knew Mother and Lucindy weren't frettin' about me."
He must have been suffering terribly, but he thought of the women who loved him before himself, and, busy as I was, I snatched a moment to send a few words of hope to the old mother. Then I left him layin' easy, though the prospect of some months of wearing pain would have daunted most men. If I had needed anything to increase my regard for Joe, it would have been the courage with which he bore a very bad quarter of an hour with the surgeons, for his arm was in a dangerous state, the wound in the head feverish for want of care, and a heavy cold on the lungs suggested pneumonia as an added trial to his list of ills.
"He will have a hard time of it, but I think he will pull through, as he is a temperate fellow with a splendid constitution," was the doctor's verdict as he left us for the next man, who was past help with a bullet through his lungs.
"I don't know as I hanker to live and be a burden. If Jim was able to do for Mother, I feel as if I wouldn't mind stepping out now I'm so fur along. As he ain't, I s'pose I must brace up and do the best I can," said Joe, as I wiped the drops from his forehead and tried to look as if his prospect was a bright one.
"You will have Lucindy to help you, you know, and that will make things easier for all."
"Think so? 'Pears to me I couldn't ask her to take care of three invalids for my sake. She ain't no folks of her own, nor much means, and ought to marry a man who can make things easy for her. Guess I'll have to wait a spell longer before I say anything to Lucindy about marrying now."
And a look of resolute resignation settled on Joe's haggard face as he gave up his dearest hope.
"I think Lucindy will have something to say, if she is like most women, and you will find the burdens much lighter for sharing them between you. Don't worry about that, but get well, and go home as soon as you can."
"All right, ma'am," and Joe proved himself a good soldier by obeying orders and falling asleep like a tired child as the first step toward recovery. For 2 months, I saw Joe daily, and learned to like him very much. He was so honest genuine, and kind-hearted, so did his mates, for he made friends with them all by sharing such small luxuries as came to him, for he was a favorite. And better still, he made sunshine in that sad place by the brave patience with which he bore his own troubles, the cheerful consolation he always gave to others. A droll fellow was Joe at times, for under his sobriety lay much humor, and I soon discovered that a visit from him was more efficacious than other cordials in cases of despondency and discontent. Roars of laughter sometimes greeted me as I went into his ward, and Joe's jokes were passed round as eagerly as the water pitcher. Yes, he had much to try him, not only in the ills that vexed his flesh, but the cares that tried his spirit, and the future that lay before him, full of anxieties and responsibilities, which seemed so heavy now when the strong right arm that had cleared all obstacles away before was gone. The letters I wrote for him, and those he received, told the little story very plainly, for he read them to me, and found much comfort in talking over his affairs, as most men do when illness makes them dependent on a woman. Jim was evidently sick and selfish. Lucindy, to judge from the photograph cherished so tenderly under Joe's pillow, was a pretty, weak sort of a girl, with little character or courage to help poor Joe with his burdens. The old mother was very like her son and stood by him like a hero, as he said, but was evidently failing, and begged him to come home as soon as he was able, that she might see him comfortably settled before she must leave him. Her courage sustained his, and the longing to see her hastened his departure as soon as it was safe to let him go. For Lucindy's letters were always of a dismal sort, and made him anxious to put his shoulder to the wheel. She always set considerable by me, mother did, being the oldest, and I wouldn't miss making her last days happy, not if it cost me all the arms and legs I've got, said Joe, as he awkwardly struggled into the big boots an hour after leave to go home was given him. It was pleasant to see his comrades gather round him with such hearty adieus that his one hand must have tingled, to hear the good wishes and the thanks called after him by pale creatures in their beds, and to find tears in many eyes besides my own when he was gone. And nothing was left of him but the empty cot, the old gray wrapper, and the name upon the wall. I kept that card among my other relics, and hoped to meet Joe again somewhere in the world. He sent me one or two letters, then I went home. The war ended soon after. Time passed, and the little story of my Maine lumberman was laid away with many other experiences which made that part of my life a very memorable one. End of part 2. Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. My Red Cap, Part 3, by Louisa May Alcott. Some years later, as I looked out of my window one dull November day, the only cheerful thing I saw was the red cap of a messenger who was examining the slate that hung on a wall opposite my hotel. A tall man with gray hair and beard, one arm, and a blue army coat. I always salute, figuratively at least, when I see that familiar blue, especially if one sleeve of the coat is empty. So I watched the messenger with interest as he trudged away on some new errand, wishing he had a better day and a thicker pair of boots. He was an unusually large, well-made man, and reminded me of a fine building going to ruin before its time. For the broad shoulders were bent, there was a stiffness about the long legs suggestive of wounds or rheumatism, and the curly hair looked as if snow had fallen on it too soon. Sitting at work in my window, I fell into the way of watching my red cap, as I called him, with more interest than I did the fat doves on the roof opposite, or the pert sparrows hopping in the mud below. I liked the steady way in which he plodded on through fair weather or foul, as if intent on doing well the one small service he had found to do. I liked his cheerful whistle as he stood waiting for a job under the porch of the public building where his slate hung, watching the luxurious carriages roll by and the well-to-do gentlemen who daily passed him to their comfortable homes, with a steady, patient sort of face, as if wondering at the inequalities of fortune, yet neither melancholy nor morose over the small share of prosperity which had fallen to his lot. I often planned to give him a job, that I might see him nearer, but I had few errands, and little Bob, the hall boy, depended on doing those, so the winter was nearly over before I found out that my red cap was an old friend. A parcel came for me one day, and bidding the man wait for an answer, I sat down to write it, while the messenger stood just inside the door like a sentinel on duty. When I looked up to give my note and directions, I found the man staring at me with a beaming yet bashful face, as he nodded, saying heartily, "I mistrusted it was you, ma'am. Soon's I see the name on the bundle, and I guess I ain't wrong. It's a number of years since we met, and you don't remember Joe Collins as well as he does you, I reckon." "Why, how you have changed! I've been seeing you every day all winter, and never knew you," I said, shaking hands with my old patient, and very glad to see him. "Nigh on 20 years makes considerable of a change in folks, especially if they have a pretty hard row to hoe."
"Sit down and warm yourself while you tell me all about it. There is no hurry for this answer, and I'll pay for your time."
Joe laughed as if that was a good joke, and sat down as if the fire was quite as welcome as the friend. "How are they all at home?" I asked, as he sat turning his cap round, not quite knowing where to begin.
"I haven't got any home, nor any folks neither." And the melancholy words banished the brightness from his rough face like a cloud. "Mother died soon after I got back. Sudden. But she was ready, and I was there, so she was happy. Jim lived a number of years, and was a sight of care, poor feller. But we managed to rub along, though we had to sell the farm, for I couldn't do much with one arm, and doctor's bills right along stiddy take a heap of money. He was as comfortable as he could be, and when he was gone, it wasn't no great matter, for there was only me, and I don't mind roughing it."
"But Lucindy, where was she?" I asked very naturally.
"Oh, she married another man long ago. Couldn't expect her to take me and my misfortunes. She's doing well, I hear, and that's a comfort anyway." There was a look on Joe's face, a tone in Joe's voice as he spoke, that plainly showed how much he had needed comfort when left to bear his misfortunes all alone. But he made no complaint, uttered no reproach, and loyally excused Lucindy's desertion with a simple sort of dignity that made it impossible to express pity or condemnation.
"How came you here, Joe?" I asked, making a sudden leap from past to present.
"I had to scratch for a livin', and can't do much, so after trying a number of things I found this. My old wounds pester me a good deal, and rheumatism is bad winters, but while my legs hold out, I can get on. A man can't set down and starve, so I keep wagging as long as I can. When I can't do no more, I suppose there's almshouse and hospital ready for me.
That is a dismal prospect, Joe. There ought to be a comfortable place for such as you to spend your last days in. I am sure you have earned it.
Well, it does seem rather hard on us when we've given all we had and gave it free and hearty to be left to knock about in our old age. But there's so many poor folks to be took care of. We don't get much of a chance, for we ain't the begging sort, said Joe with a wistful look at the wintry world outside, as if it would be better to lie quiet under the snow than to drag out his last painful years, friendless and forgotten, in some refuge of the poor.
Some kind people have been talking of a home for soldiers, and I hope the plan will be carried out. It will take time, but if it comes to pass, you shall be one of the first men to enter that home, Joe, if I can get you there.
That sounds mighty cheerin' and comfortable. Thank you, ma'am. Idleness is dreadful trying to me, and I'd rather wear out than rust out. So I guess I can weather it a spell longer. But it will be pleasant to look forward to a snug harbor by me by. I feel a sight better just hearin' tell about it.
He certainly looked so, faint as the hope was, for the melancholy eyes brightened as if they already saw a happier refuge in the future than almshouse, hospital, or grave, and when he trudged away upon my errand, he went as briskly as if every step took him nearer to the promised home. After that day, it was all up with Bob, for I told my neighbors Joe's story, and we kept him trotting busily, adding little gifts and taking the sort of interest in him that comforted the lonely fellow, and made him feel that he had not outlived his usefulness. I never looked out when he was at his post that he did not smile back at me. I never passed him in the street that the red cap was not touched with a military flourish. And, when any of us beckoned to him, no twinge of rheumatism was too sharp to keep him from hurrying to do our errands, as if he had Mercury's winged feet. Now and then he came in for a chat, and always asked how the soldiers' home was prospering, expressing his opinion that Boston was the charitablest city under the sun, and he was sure he and his mates would be took care of somehow. When we parted in the spring, I told him things looked hopeful, bade him be ready for a good long rest as soon as the hospitable doors were open, and left him nodding cheerfully. End of part 3. Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. My Red Cap, Part 4, by Louisa May Alcott. But in the autumn, I looked in vain for Joe. The slate was in its old place, and a messenger came and went on his beat. But a strange face was under the red cap, and this man had two arms and one eye. I asked for Collins, but the newcomer had only a vague idea that he was dead, and the same answer was given me at headquarters, though none of the busy people seemed to know when or where he died. So I mourned for Joe, and felt that it was very hard he could not have lived to enjoy the promised refuge, for relying upon the charity that never fails, The home was an actual fact now, just beginning its beneficent career. People were waking up to this duty. Money was coming in, meetings were being held, and already a few poor fellows were in the refuge, feeling themselves no longer paupers, but invalid soldiers honorably supported by the state they had served. Talking it over one day with a friend who spent her life working for the Associated Charities, she said, "By the way, there is a man boarding with one of my poor women who ought to be got into the home if he will go. I don't know much about him, except that he was in the army, has been very ill with rheumatic fever, and is friendless. I asked Mrs. Flanagan how she managed to keep him, and she said she had help while he was sick, and now he is able to hobble about, he takes care of the children, so she is able to go out to work. He won't go to his own town, because there is nothing for him there but the almshouse, and he dreads a hospital, so struggles along, trying to earn his bread tending babies with his one arm. A sad case, and in your line. I wish you'd look into it." "That sounds like my Joe, one arm and all. I'll go and see him. I've a weakness for soldiers, sick or well." I went, and never shall forget the pathetic little tableau I saw as I opened Mrs. Flanagan's dingy door, for she was out, and no one heard my tap. The room was redolent of suds, and in a grove of damp clothes hung on lines sat a man with a crying baby laid across his lap, while he fed three small children standing at his knee with bread and molasses. How he managed with one arm to keep the baby from squirming onto the floor, the plate from upsetting, and to feed the hungry urchins who stood in a row with open mouths, like young birds, was past my comprehension. But he did, trotting baby gently, dealing out sweet morsels patiently, and whistling to himself, as if to beguile his labors cheerfully. The broad back, the long legs, the faded coat, the low whistle were all familiar, and dodging a wet sheet, I faced the man to find it was indeed my Joe, a mere shadow of his former self, after months of suffering that had crippled him for life, but brave and patient still, trying to help himself and not ask aid though brought so low. For an instant I could not speak to him, and encumbered with baby, dish, spoon, and children, he could only stare at me with a sudden brightening of the altered face that made it full of welcome before a word was uttered. "They told me you were dead, and I only heard of you by accident, not knowing I should find my old friend alive, but not well, I'm afraid." "There ain't much left of me but bones and pain, ma'am. I'm powerful glad to see you all the same. Dust off a chair, Patsy, and let the lady set down. You go in the corner and take turns licking the dish while I see company," said Joe, disbanding his small troop and shouldering the baby as if presenting arms in honor of his guest. "Why didn't you let me know how sick you were? And how came they to think you dead?" I asked, as he festooned the wet linen out of the way and prepared to enjoy himself as best he could. "I did send once, when things was at the worst, but you hadn't got back, and then somehow I thought I was going to be mustered out for good, and so wouldn't trouble nobody. But my orders ain't come yet, and I'm doing the first thing that come along. It ain't much, but the good soul stood by me, and I ain't ashamed to pay my debts this way, since I can't do it in no other." And Joe cradled the chubby baby in his one arm as tenderly as if it had been his own, though little Biddy was not an inviting infant. "That is very beautiful and right, Joe, and I honor you for it. But you were not meant to tend babies, So sing your last lullabies and be ready to go to the home as soon as I can get you there."
"Really, ma'am?" "I used to lay and kind of dream about it when I couldn't stir without yelling out, but I never thought it would ever come to happen. I see a piece in the paper describing it, and it sounded dreadful nice. Shouldn't wonder if I found some of my mates there. They were a good lot and deserving of all that could be done for 'em," said Joe, trotting the baby briskly, as if the prospect excited him, as well it might, for the change from that damp nursery to the comfortable quarters prepared for him would be like going from purgatory to paradise.
"I don't wonder you don't get well living in such a place, Joe. You should have gone home to Woolwich and let your friends help you," I said, feeling provoked with him for hiding himself.
"No, ma'am," he answered with a look I never shall forget. It was so full of mingled patience, pride, and pain. "I haven't a relation in the world but a couple of poor old aunts, and they couldn't do anything for me. As for asking help of folks I used to know, I couldn't do it. And if you think I'd go to Lucindy, though she is wall off, you don't know Joe Collins. I'd die first. If she was poor and I rich, I'd do for her like a brother, but I couldn't ask no favors of her, not if I begged my victuals in the street or starved. I forgive, but I don't forget in a hurry, and the woman that stood by me when I was down is the woman I believe in, and can take my bread from without shame. Hooray for Biddy Flanagan! God bless her!" And as if to find a vent for the emotion that filled his eyes with grateful tears, Joe led off the cheer, which the children shrilly echoed, and I joined heartily.
"I shall come for you in a few days, so cuddle the baby and make much of the children before you part. It won't take you long to pack up, will it?" I asked as we subsided with a general laugh.
"I reckon not, as I don't own any clothes but what I set in, except a couple of old shirts and them socks. My hat's stoppin' up the winder, and my old coat is my bed cover. I'm awful shabby, ma'am, and that's one reason I don't go out more. I can hobble some, but I ain't got used to being a scarecrow yet." And Joe glanced from the hose without heels that hung on the line to the ragged suit he wore, with a resigned expression that made me long to rush out and buy up half the contents of Oak Hall on the spot. Curbing this wild impulse, I presently departed with promises of speedy transportation for Joe and unlimited oranges to assuage the pangs of parting for the young Flanagans, who escorted me to the door, while Joe waved the baby like a triumphal banner till I got round the corner. There was such a beautiful absence of red tape about the new institution that it only needed a word in the right ear to set things going. And then, with a long pull, a strong pull, and a pull all together, Joe Collins was taken up and safely landed in the home he so much needed and so well deserved. A happier man, or a more grateful one, it would be hard to find. And if a visitor wants an enthusiastic guide about the place, Joe is the one to take. For all is comfort, sunshine, and goodwill to him, and he unconsciously shows how great the need of this refuge is as he hobbles about on his lame feet, pointing out its beauties, conveniences, and delights with his one arm, while his face shines and his voice quavers a little as he says gratefully, "The state don't forget us, you see. And this is a home worth having. Long life to it." End of part 4. End of My Red Cap by Louisa May Alcott.
Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. Nellie's Hospital by Louisa May Alcott. Nellie sat beside her mother picking lint, but while her fingers flew, her eyes often looked wistfully out into the meadow, golden with buttercups and bright with sunshine. Presently she said, rather bashfully, but very earnestly, "Mama, I want to tell you a little plan I've made, if you'll please not laugh." "I think I can safely promise that, my dear," said her mother, putting down her work that she might listen quite respectfully. Nellie looked pleased, and went on confidingly. "Since Brother Will came home with his lame foot, and I've helped you tend him, I've heard a great deal about hospitals, and liked it very much. Today I said I wanted to go and be a nurse, like Aunt Mercy, but Will laughed, and told me I'd better begin by nursing sick birds and butterflies and pussies before I tried to take care of men. I did not like to be made fun of, but I've been thinking that it would be very pleasant to have a little hospital all my own, and be a nurse in it, because, if I took pains, so many pretty creatures might be made well, perhaps. Could I, Mama?" Her mother wanted to smile at the idea, but did not, for Nellie looked up with her heart and eyes so full of tender compassion, both for the unknown men for whom her little hands had done their best, and for the smaller sufferers nearer home, that she stroked the shining head and answered readily, "Yes, Nellie, it will be a proper charity for such a young Samaritan, and you may learn much if you are in earnest. You must study how to feed and nurse your little patients, else your pity will do no good, and your hospital become a prison. I will help you, and Tony shall be your surgeon."
"Oh, Mama, how good you always are to me! Indeed, I am in truly earnest. I will learn, I will be kind, and may I go now and begin?"
"You may, but tell me first, where will you have your hospital?"
"In my room, Mama. It is so snug and sunny, and I never should forget it there," said Nellie.
"You must not forget it anywhere. I think that plan will not do. How would you like to find caterpillars walking in your bed, to hear sick pussies mewing in the night, to have beetles clinging to your clothes, or see mice, bugs, and birds tumbling downstairs whenever the door was open?" said her mother. Nellie laughed at that thought a minute, then clapped her hands and cried,
"Let us have the old summer house. My doves only use the upper part, and it would be so like Frank in the storybook. Please say yes again, Mama."
Her mother did say yes, and snatching up her hat, Nellie ran to find Tony, the gardener's son, a pleasant lad of 12, who was Nellie's favorite playmate. Tony pronounced the plan a jolly one, and, leaving his work, followed his young mistress to the summer house, for she could not wait one minute.
"What must we do first?"
she asked, as they stood looking in at the dusty room, full of garden tools, bags of seeds, old flower pots, and watering cans.
"Clear out the rubbish, miss," answered Tony.
"Here it goes, then," and Nellie began bundling everything out in such haste that she broke 2 flower pots, scattered all the squash seeds, and brought a pile of rakes and hoes clattering down about her ears.
"Just wait a bit and let me take the lead, miss. You hand me things, I'll pile 'em in the barrow and wheel 'em off to the barn. Then it will save time and be finished up tidy."
Nellie did as he advised,
and very soon nothing but dust remained. "What next?" she asked, not knowing in the least.
"I'll sweep up while you see if Polly can come and scrub the room out. It ought to be done before you stay here, let alone the patients."
"So it had," said Nelly, looking very wise all of a sudden. "Will says the wards," that means the rooms, Tony, "are scrubbed every day or two and kept very clean and well venti-something. I can't say it, but it means having a plenty of air come in. I can clean windows while Polly mops, and then we shall soon be done." Away she ran, feeling very busy and important. Polly came, and very soon the room looked like another place. The four latticed windows were set wide open, so the sunshine came dancing through the vines that grew outside, and curious roses peeped in to see what frolic was afoot. The walls shone white again, for not a spider dared to stay. The wide seat which encircled the room was dustless now, the floor as nice as willing hands could make it, and the south wind blew away all musty odors with its fragrant breath.
"How fine it looks!" cried Nelly, dancing on the doorstep, lest a footprint should mar the still damp floor.
"I'd almost like to fall sick for the sake of staying here," said Tony admiringly. "Now what sort of beds are you going to have, miss?"
"I suppose it won't do to put butterflies and toads and worms into beds like the real soldiers where Will was," answered Nelly, looking anxious. Tony could hardly help shouting at the idea, but rather than trouble his little mistress, he said very soberly,
"I'm afraid they wouldn't lay easy, not being used to it. Tucking up a butterfly would about kill him. The worms would be apt to get lost among the bedclothes, and the toads would tumble out the first thing."
"I shall have to ask Mama about it. What will you do while I'm gone?" said Nelly, unwilling that a moment should be lost.
"I'll make frames for nettings to the windows, else the doves will come in and eat up the sick people."
"I think they will know that it is a hospital, and be too kind to hurt or frighten their neighbors," began Nelly. But as she spoke, a plump white dove walked in, looked about with its red-ringed eyes, and quietly pecked up a tiny bug that had just ventured out from the crack where it had taken refuge when the deluge came.
"Yes, we must have nettings. I'll ask Mama for some lace," said Nelly, when she saw that,
and taking her pet dove on her shoulder, told it about her hospital as she went toward the house, for loving all little creatures as she did, it grieved her to have any harm befall even the least or plainest of them. She had a sweet child fancy that her playmates understood her language as she did theirs, and that birds, flowers, animals, and insects felt for her the same affection which she felt for them. Love always makes friends, and nothing seemed to fear the gentle child, but welcomed her like a little sun who shone alike on all, and never suffered an eclipse. She was gone some time, and when she came back, her mind was full of new plans, one hand full of rushes, the other of books, while over her head floated the lace, and a bright green ribbon hung across her arm.
"Mama says that the best beds will be little baskets, boxes, cages, and any sort of thing that suits the patients, for each will need different care and food and medicine. I have not baskets enough, so as I cannot have pretty white beds, I am going to braid pretty green nests for my patients, and while I do it, Mama thought you'd read to me the pages she has marked, so that we may begin right."
"Yes, miss, I like that. But what is the ribbon for?" asked Tony.
"Oh, that's for you. Will says that if you are to be an army surgeon, you must have a green band on your arm. So I got this to tie on when we play hospital."
Tony let her decorate the sleeve of his gray jacket, and when the nettings were done, the welcome books were opened and enjoyed. It was a happy time, sitting in the sunshine with leaves pleasantly astir all about them, doves cooing overhead, and flowers sweetly gossiping together through the summer afternoon. Nelly wove her smooth green rushes, Tony pored over his pages, and both found something better than fairy legends in the family histories of insects, birds, and beasts. All manner of wonders appeared, and were explained to them, till Nelly felt as if a new world had been given her, so full of beauty, interest, and pleasure, that she never could be tired of studying it. Many of these things were not strange to Tony, because born among plants, he had grown up with them as if they were brothers and sisters, and the sturdy, brown-faced boy had learned many lessons which no poet or philosopher could have taught him, unless he had become as childlike as himself, and studied from the same great book. When the baskets were done, the marked pages all read, and the sun began to draw his rosy curtains round him before smiling good night, Nelly ranged the green beds round the room, Tony put in the screens, and the hospital was ready. The little nurse was so excited that she could hardly eat her supper, and directly afterwards ran up to tell Will how well she had succeeded with the first part of her enterprise. Now, Brother Will was a brave young officer, who had fought stoutly and done his duty like a man. But when lying weak and wounded at home, the cheerful courage which had led him safely through many dangers seemed to have deserted him, and he was often gloomy, sad, or fretful, because he longed to be at his post again, and time passed very slowly. This troubled his mother, and made Nelly wonder why he found lying in a pleasant room so much harder than fighting battles or making weary marches. Anything that interested and amused him was very welcome, and when Nelly, climbing on the arm of his sofa, told her plans, mishaps, and successes, he laughed out more heartily than he had done for many a day, and his thin face began to twinkle with fun as it used to do so long ago. That pleased Nelly, and she chatted like any affectionate little magpie, till Will was really interested, for when one is ill, small things amuse. "Do you expect your patients to come to you, Nelly?" he asked.
"No, I shall go and look for them. I often see poor things suffering in the garden and the wood, and always feel as if they ought to be taken care of, as people are."
"You wouldn't like to carry insane bugs, lame toads, and convulsive kittens in your hands, and they would not stay on a stretcher if you had one. You should have an ambulance, and be a branch of the Sanitary Commission," said Will. Nelly had often heard the words, but did not quite understand what they meant, so Will told her of that great, never-failing charity to which thousands owe their lives, and the child listened with lips apart, eyes often full, and so much love and admiration in her heart that she could find no words in which to tell it. When her brother paused, she said earnestly,
"Yes, I will be a sanitary. This little cart of mine shall be my ambulance, and I'll never let my water barrels go empty, never drive too fast, or be rough with my poor passengers, like some of the men you tell about. Does this look like an ambulance, Will?"
"Not a bit, but it shall, if you and Mama like to help me. I want 4 long bits of cane, a square white cloth, some pieces of thin wood, and the gum pot," said Will, sitting up to examine the little cart, feeling like a boy again as he took out his knife and began to whittle. Upstairs and downstairs ran Nelly till all necessary materials were collected, and almost breathlessly
she watched her brother arch the canes over the cart, cover them with the cloth, and fit an upper shelf of small compartments, each lined with cotton wool to serve as beds for wounded insects, lest they should hurt one another or jostle out. The lower part was left free for any larger creatures which Nelly might find. Among her toys, she had a tiny cask which only needed a peg to be watertight. This was filled and fitted in before, because as the small sufferers needed no seats, there was no place for it behind, and as Nelly was both horse and driver, it was more convenient in front. On each side of it stood a box of stores. In one were minute rollers, as bandages were called, a few bottles not yet filled, and a wee doll's jar of cold cream, because Nelly could not feel that her outfit was complete without a medicine chest. The other box was full of crumbs, bits of sugar, bird seed, and grains of wheat and corn, lest any famished stranger should die for want of food before she got it home. Then Mama painted U.S. SanCom in bright letters on the cover, and Nelly received her charitable plaything with a long sigh of satisfaction.
9 o'clock already! Bless me, what a short evening this has been! Exclaimed Will, as Nelly came to give him her good-night kiss.
And such a happy one! She answered. Thank you very much, dear Will. I only wish my little ambulance was big enough for you to go in. I'd so like to give you the first ride.
Nothing I should like better if it were possible, though I've a prejudice against ambulances in general. But as I cannot ride, I'll try and hop out to your hospital tomorrow and see how you get on. Which was a great deal for Captain Will to say, because he had been too listless to leave his sofa for several days. That promise sent Nelly happily away to bed, only stopping to pop her head out of the window to see if it was likely to be a fair day tomorrow, and to tell Tony about the new plan as he passed below.
"Where shall you go to look for your first load of sick folks, miss?" he asked.
"All round the garden first, then through the grove and home across the brook. Do you think I can find any patients so?" said Nelly.
"I know you will. Good night, miss." And Tony walked away with a merry look on his face that Nelly would not have understood if she had seen it. Up rose the sun bright and early, and up rose Nurse Nelly almost as early and as bright. Breakfast was taken in a great hurry, and before the dew was off the grass this branch of the S.C. was all astir. Papa, Mama, Big Brother and Baby Sister, men and maids, all looked out to see the funny little ambulance depart, and nowhere in all the summer fields was there a happier child than Nelly, as she went smiling down the garden path, where tall flowers kissed her as she passed, and every blithe bird seemed singing a good speed.
"How I wonder what I shall find first," she thought, looking sharply on all sides as she went. Crickets chirped, grasshoppers leaped, ants worked busily at their subterranean houses, spiders spun shining webs from twig to twig, bees were coming for their bags of gold, and butterflies had just begun their holiday. A large white one alighted on the top of the ambulance, walked over the inscription as if spelling it letter by letter, then floated away from flower to flower like one carrying the good news far and wide.
"Now everyone will know about the hospital and be glad to see me coming," thought Nelly. And indeed it seemed so, for just then a blackbird sitting on a garden wall burst out with a song full of musical joy. Nelly's kitten came running after to stare at the wagon and rub her soft side against it. A bright-eyed toad looked out from his cool bower among the lily leaves. And at that minute
Nellie found her first patient. In one of the dewy cobwebs hanging from a shrub nearby sat a fat black and yellow spider, watching a fly whose delicate wings were just caught in the net. The poor fly buzzed pitifully and struggled so hard that the whole web shook. But the more he struggled, the more he entangled himself, and the fierce spider was preparing to descend that it might weave a shroud about its prey, when a little finger broke the threads and lifted the fly safely into the palm of a hand, where he lay faintly humming his thanks. Nellie had heard much about contrabands, knew who they were, and was very much interested in them. So when she freed the poor black fly, she played he was her contraband, and felt glad that her first patient was one that needed help so much. Carefully brushing away as much of the web as she could, she left small Pompey, as she named him, to free his own legs, lest her clumsy fingers should hurt him. Then she laid him in one of the soft beds with a grain or two of sugar if he needed refreshment, and bade him rest and recover from his fright, remembering that he was at liberty to fly away whenever he liked, because she had no wish to make a slave of him. Feeling very happy over this new friend, Nellie went on singing softly as she walked, and presently she found a pretty caterpillar dressed in brown fur. Although the day was warm, he lay so still she thought him dead, till he rolled himself into a ball as she touched him. "I think you are either faint from the heat of this thick coat of yours, or that you are going to make a cocoon of yourself, Mr. Fuzz," said Nellie. "Now I want to see you turn into a butterfly, so I shall take you, and if you get lively again, I will let you go. I shall play that you have given out on a march, as the soldiers sometimes do, and been left behind for the sanitary people to see to." In went sulky Mr. Fuzz, and on trundled the ambulance, till a golden-green rose beetle was discovered, laying on his back, kicking as if in a fit. "Dear me, what shall I do for him?" thought Nellie. "He acts as Baby did when she was so ill, and Mama put her in a warm bath. I haven't got my little tub here, or any hot water, and I'm afraid the beetle would not like it if I had. Perhaps he has pain in his stomach? I'll turn him over and pat his back as nurse does babies when she cries for pain like that." She set the beetle on his legs and did her best to comfort him, but he was evidently in great distress, for he could not walk, and instead of lifting his emerald overcoat and spreading the wings that lay underneath, he turned over again and kicked more violently than before. Not knowing what to do, Nellie put him into one of her soft nests for Tony to cure if possible. She found no more patients in the garden except a dead bee, which she wrapped in a leaf and took home to bury. When she came to the grove, it was so green and cool she longed to sit and listen to the whisper of the pines and watch the larch tassels wave in the wind. But, recollecting her charitable errand, she went rustling along the pleasant path till she came to another patient, over which she stood considering several minutes before she could decide whether it was best to take it to her hospital, because it was a little gray snake with bruised tail. She knew it would not hurt her, yet she was afraid of it. She thought it pretty, yet could not like it. She pitied its pain, yet shrunk from helping it, for it had a fiery eye and a keep quivering tongue that looked as if longing to bite. "He is a rebel. I wonder if I ought to be good to him," thought Nellie, watching the reptile writhe with pain. "Will said there were sick rebels in his hospital, and one was very kind to him. It says, too, in my little book, 'Love your enemies.' I think snakes are mine,
but I guess I'll try and love him because God made him. Some boy will kill him if I leave him here, and then perhaps his mother will be very sad about it. Come, poor worm, I wish to help you, so be patient and don't frighten me." Then Nelly laid her little handkerchief on the ground, and with a stick gently lifted the wounded snake upon it, and folding it together, laid it in the ambulance. She was thoughtful after that, and so busy puzzling her young head about the duty of loving those who hate us, and being kind to those who are disagreeable or unkind, that she went through the rest of the wood quite forgetful of her work. A soft "queek, queek," made her look up and listen. The sound came from the long meadow grass, and bending it carefully back, she found a half-fledged bird with one wing trailing on the ground, and its eyes dim with pain or hunger.
"You darling thing! Did you fall out of your nest and hurt your wing?" cried Nelly, looking up into the single tree that stood nearby. No nest was to be seen, no parent birds hovered overhead, and little Robin could only tell its troubles in that mournful "queek, queek, queek." Nelly ran to get both her chests, and sitting down beside the bird, tried to feed it. To her joy, it ate crumb after crumb, as if it were half starved, and soon fluttered nearer, a confiding fearlessness that made her very proud. Soon baby Robin seemed quite comfortable. His eye brightened, he queaked no more, and but for the drooping wing, would have been himself again. With one of her bandages, Nelly bound both wings closely to his sides for fear he should hurt himself by trying to fly. And though he seemed amazed at her proceedings, he behaved very well, only staring at her and ruffling up his few feathers in a funny way that made her laugh. Then she had to discover some way of accommodating her two larger patients so that neither should hurt nor alarm the other. A bright thought came to her after much pondering. Carefully lifting the handkerchief, she pinned the two ends to the roof of the cart, and there swung little Forked Tongue, while Rob lay easily below. By this time, Nelly began to wonder how it happened that she found so many more injured things than ever before. But it never entered her innocent head that Tony had searched the wood and meadow before she was up, and laid most of these creatures ready to her hands, that she might not be disappointed. She had not yet lost her faith in fairies, so she fancied they too belonged to her small sisterhood, and presently it did really seem impossible to doubt that the good folk had been at work. Coming to the bridge that crossed the brook, she stopped a moment to watch the water ripple over the bright pebbles, the ferns bend down to drink, and the funny tadpoles frolic in quieter nooks where the sun shone, and the dragonfly swung among the rushes. When Nelly turned to go on, her blue eyes opened wide, and the handle of the ambulance dropped with a noise that caused a stout frog to skip into the water heels overhead. Directly in the middle of the bridge was a pretty green tent, made of two tall burdock leaves. The stems were stuck into cracks between the boards, the tips were pinned together with a thorn, and one great buttercup nodded in the doorway like a sleepy sentinel. Nelly stared and smiled, listened, and looked about on every side. Nothing was seen but the quiet meadow and the shady grove. Nothing was heard but the babble of the brook and the cheery music of the bobolinks.
"Yes," said Nelly softly to herself, "that is a fairy tent, and in it I may find a baby elf sick with whooping cough or scarlet fever. How splendid it would be! Only I could never nurse such a dainty thing." Stooping eagerly, She peeped over the buttercup's drowsy head and saw what seemed a tiny cock of hay. She had no time to feel disappointed, for the haycock began to stir, and looking nearer, she beheld two silvery gray mites who wagged wee tails and stretched themselves as if they had just waked up. Nelly knew that they were young field mice and rejoiced over them, feeling rather relieved that no fairy had appeared, though she still believed them to have had a hand in the matter. "I shall call the mice my babes in the wood, because they are lost and covered up with leaves," said Nelly, as she laid them in her snuggest bed, where they nestled close together and fell fast asleep again. Being very anxious to get home, that she might tell her adventures, and show how great was the need of a sanitary commission in that region, Nelly marched proudly up the avenue, and having displayed her load, hurried to the hospital, where another applicant was waiting for her. On the step of the door lay a large turtle, with one claw gone, and on his back was pasted a bit of paper with his name, Commodore Waddle, USN. Nelly knew this was a joke of Will's, but welcomed the ancient mariner, and called Tony to help her get him in. All that morning, they were very busy settling the newcomers, for both people and books had to be consulted before they could decide what diet and treatment was best for each. The winged contraband had taken Nelly at her word, and flown away on the journey home. Little Rob was put in a large cage where he could use his legs, yet not injure his lame wing. Forktongue lay under a wire cover on sprigs of fennel, for the gardener said that snakes were fond of it. The babes in the wood were put to bed in one of the rush baskets under a cotton wool coverlet. Greenback, the beetle, found ease for his unknown aches in the warm heart of a rose, where he sunned himself all day. The Commodore was made happy in a tub of water, grass, and stones, and Mr. Fuzz was put in a well-ventilated glass box to decide whether he would be a cocoon or not. Tony had not been idle while his mistress was away, and he showed her the hospital garden he had made close by, in which were cabbage, nettle, and mignonette plants for the butterflies, flowering herbs for the bees, chickweed and hemp for the birds, catnip for the pussies, and plenty of room left for whatever other patients might need. In the afternoon, while Nelly did her task at lint-picking, talking busily to Will as she worked, and interesting him in her affairs, Tony cleared a pretty spot in the grove for the burying-ground, and made ready some small bits of slate on which to write the names of those who died. He did not have it ready an hour too soon, for at sunset two little graves were needed, and Nurse Nelly shed tender tears for her first losses as she laid the motherless mice in one smooth hollow and the gray-coated rebel in the other. She had learned to care for him already, and when she found him dead, was very glad she had been kind to him, hoping that he knew it, and died happier in her hospital than all alone in the shadowy wood. The rest of Nelly's patients prospered, and of the many aided afterward, few died, because of Tony's skillful treatment and her own faithful care. Every morning, when the day proved fair, the little ambulance went out upon its charitable errand. Every afternoon, Nelly worked for the human sufferers whom she loved, and every evening, Brother Will read aloud to her from useful books, showed her wonders with his microscope, or prescribed remedies for the patients, whom he soon knew by name and took much interest in. It was Nelly's holiday, but, though she studied no lessons, she learned much, and unconsciously made her pretty play both an example and a rebuke for others. At first, It seemed a childish pastime, and people laughed. But there was something in the familiar words sanitary, hospital, and ambulance that made them pleasant sounds to many ears. As reports of Nellie's work went through the neighborhood, other children came to see and copy her design. Rough lads looked ashamed when in her wards they found harmless creatures hurt by them, and going out they said among themselves, "We won't stone birds, chase butterflies, and drown the girls' little cats any more, though we won't tell them so." And most of the lads kept their word so well that people said there never had been so many birds before as all that summer haunted wood and field. Tender-hearted playmates brought their pets to be cured. Even busy farmers had a friendly word for the small charity, which reminded them so sweetly of the great one, which should never be forgotten. Lonely mothers sometimes looked out with wet eyes as the little ambulance went by, recalling thoughts or absent sons who might be journeying painfully to some far-off hospital, where brave women waited to tend them with hands as willing, hearts as tender, as those the gentle child gave to her self-appointed task. At home, the charm worked also. No more idle days for Nellie, or fretful ones for Will, because the little sister would not neglect the helpless creatures so dependent upon her, and the big brother was ashamed to complain after watching the patience of these lesser sufferers, and merrily said he would try to bear his own wound as quietly and bravely as the Commodore bore his. Nellie never knew how much good she had done Captain Will, till he went away again in the early autumn. Then he thanked her for it, and though she cried for joy and sorrow, she never forgot it, because he left something behind him which always pleasantly reminded her of the double success her little hospital had won. When Will was gone, and she had prayed softly in her heart that God would keep him safe and bring him home again, she dried her tears and went away to find comfort in the place where he had spent so many happy hours with her. She had not been there before that day, and when she reached the door, she stood quite still and wanted very much to cry again, for something beautiful had happened. She had often asked Will for a motto for her hospital, and he had promised to find her one. She thought he had forgotten it, but even in the hurry of that busy day, he had found time to do more than keep his word, while Nellie sat indoors, lovingly brightening the tarnished buttons on his blue coat that had seen so many battles. Above the roof, where the doves cooed in the sun, now rustled a white flag with the golden SC shining on it as the wind tossed it to and fro. Below, on the smooth panel of the door, a skillful pencil had drawn two arching ferns, in whose soft shadow, poised upon a mushroom, stood a little figure of Nurse Nellie, and underneath it another of Dr. Tony bottling medicine, with spectacles upon his nose. Both hands of the miniature Nellie were outstretched, as if beckoning to a train of insects, birds, and beasts, which was so long that it not only circled round the lower rim of this fine sketch, but dwindled in the distance to mere dots and lines. Such merry conceits as one found there! A mouse bringing the tail it had lost in some cruel trap, a door bug with a shade over its eyes, an invalid butterfly carried in a tiny litter by long-legged spiders, a fat frog with gouty feet hopping upon crutches, Jenny Wren sobbing in a nice handkerchief as she brought dear dead Cock Robin to be restored to life, rabbits, lambs, cats, calves, and turtles, all came trooping up to be healed by the benevolent little maid who welcomed them so heartily.
Nelly laughed at these comical mites till the tears ran down her cheeks, and thought she never could be tired of looking at them. But presently she saw four lines clearly printed underneath her picture, and her childish face grew sweetly serious as she read the words of a great poet, which Will had made both compliment and motto. "He prayeth best who loveth best all things both great and small. For the dear God who loveth us, he made them and loveth all." End of Nelly's Hospital by Louisa May Alcott.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
If you want jazz music, go to New Orleans. Bagels, New York. And for psychics, think California Psychics. You want the best? You go to the best. At California Psychics, home of free spirits and open minds, we know better than anyone what makes a good psychic. That's why we guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.